Morning. Today's daf is Yetes in Sanhedrin. A day from yesterday, we began the new perek. We talked about a king and a kohen gadol and the relationship to the whole judicial process. The Mishnah noted the general distinction between a kohen gadol and the king. Kohen gadol, as it relates to the judicial system, can be part and parcel of the judicial system. A kohen gadol can serve as a judge, he could serve as a witness, he could be testified against. In other words, a kohen gadol, for all intents and purposes, is really part of the whole judicial process. When it comes to the king, however, the king is going to be divorced from the judicial process. At least that's a simple reading of the Mishnah. As we go on later today, we're going to see that that's not entirely so, but at least for the simple reading of the Mishnah, a king cannot be part of the judicial process. Why should that be? We haven't yet unearthed that information, but that is what we started with yesterday in terms of the second parak of Sanhedrin. We're going to pick up today right where we left off yesterday. We're starting with the words Gufa. We are on Yechesim and Base. We're about two-thirds of the way down, and a continuation of what we were doing yesterday. That one is not allowed to appoint a king as part of the Sanhedrin. And you're not allowed to appoint a king nor a kohen gadol as part of the Beis Din that's going to be making the determination of whether or not we should be adding a month to the year or not. Extensively, in the first parak of Sanhedrin, we just did less than a week ago, the discussion of what are the factors that are involved in terms of deciding and determining whether we're going to add a month to the year, Ibr Shana. So in terms of who's making this decision, so the Brisa tells us it's not going to be the king, and it's not going to be the kohen gadol. Now the Gemara says, Melch b'Sanhedrin dichsiv. Now, in terms of not appointing a king as a member of the Sanhedrin, so the Gemara says, I'll tell you why. Because we know that Pasuk says, lo sana al riv, and the Gemara dashens, lo sana al rav. Do not contest the opinion of someone greater than you. So if you have a king who's a member of the Sanhedrin and he voices an opinion, so who can argue with that position? Nobody can argue with that position. He's a king. And so therefore, you can't have that as part of the Sanhedrin. Meaning, you can't have somebody who is going to state an opinion and nobody's going to argue with you. The whole point of the Sanhedrin, the whole point of a Beis Din, is so that there is differing opinions, and through the differing opinions, you're going to have some sort of realization of the truth. But if you have an opinion in the Sanhedrin who nobody can argue with, so that's not, he can't be a functioning member of the Sanhedrin. So, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, it's coming up later. Yes. Okay. So, lo melech v'kohen gadol b'ibur shana. Now, as far as the king and the kohen gadol is concerned, so they can't be involved in ibur shana. Now, why should that be? Melech mishum afsanya. So, as far as the king is concerned, the reason why he cannot become part of the decision process of adding a month is because he does not have impartiality. In fact, he's very partial. The Rashi explains what the Gemara means with this answer, and the Rashi explains that when the king hires his military force, so he's paying them a set fee for the year. So, if you're going to have workers work for you, and you're giving them a set fee for the year, so would you like them to work for you for 12 months or 13 months? It's a no-brainer. You, of course, want them to work for you for 13 months. That's an extra month at no extra cost to you. So, if you ask the king, do you want to add another month to the year? Every year, his answer is going to be yes. Okay, now, you'd like to think that the king can also think about the national needs of the people. That's all true, but if there is a financial benefit to the king on the decision, so it cannot be part of that decision. And as far as Kohen Gadol, why is the Kohen Gadol also not going to be impartial when it comes to the decision of adding an extra month? So the Gemara also gives a very terse explanation, Mishum Tzina, because it's cold. What does that mean, it's cold? Remember, as we've discussed in the first paragraph of Sanhedrin, every time you're adding another month, you're adding an extra Adar, you're pushing the Yomim Tovim into the seasons. So that means that Pesach is going to be pushed off another month into the season. So if it's early spring, Pesach will be in middle spring. If it's late winter, Pesach is going to be early spring, etc., etc. And that also means that the same thing's going to happen to Sukkos. Or let's focus really now on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, now Yom Kippur is going to be pushed a month ahead into the late fall, perhaps even early winter. Now, as far as the Kohen Gadol is concerned, so remember, he's got a tov on the mikvah on Yom Kippur five times. Toveling in the mikvah on Yom Kippur and five times, so he's thinking about that mikvah. And if you're now pushing Yom Kippur into the winter, into the late fall, early winter, so that's going to be a cold mikvah. At least that's Rashi's explanation. Tosfos, however, doesn't like that explanation because Tosfos reminds us that the Gemara in Yuma does seem to indicate that the mikvah was warmed up. It was a heated mikvah. So Tosfos talks about the floor being cold either way. The point being is that, again, the Kohen Gadol thinking about Avodas Yom Kippurim, so he also is going to have a bias, and therefore he can't be part of it. It can't be part of this selection.
What about the
Correct. But in other words, those are agreed. But those are the national factors in terms of making the decision. But because these two people, meaning the Kohen Gadol and the king, have personal biases, so therefore they can't be part of the selection process. Amra Papa Shmaminas Rapapa says, what do you see from here? Shasar Basiyar Chazal. That as far as the year is concerned, the year follows the months. Now I know that what does that mean? It doesn't sound like he's saying a lot, but he is saying a lot. Meaning what Rapapa's saying is that look, as far as the seasons go, seasons are the seasons. And when you push a month, when you add an extra adar and you push the months forward, so that means now that the Yomim Tovim are going to go into the a month later into the season. Meaning, just because we add another adar is not going to change the seasons. So the Gemara says now. So what it sounds like now is that sometimes there's simply not going to be coordination between the season of the year and the Yomim Tovim, as we just described. But Ini the Gemara says, but is that true? V'hanacha gimel roi bakar davakayim v'shamina rabbanan dika amre. So the Gemara says, yeah, but you know what? I don't know if that's true because of the following. There were three cattle herders, and they were having a dialogue, and the rabbis overheard the dialogue. And Chad Amar and each one of them had a comment about the season. Chad Amar, im bachir v'lakish kechada yenitz. If the late harvest and the early harvest are coming simultaneously, meaning we're basically talking about the barley and the wheat. Barley comes early, wheat comes later. So the barley is barley were at the late harvest and wheat were at the early harvest. But if they're coming around the same time, so dinuaja. So we basically that's adar. Meaning what they're doing is that they're assuming that there's a coordination between the lunar Jewish month and the season. And the imlab leisein adar. And if not, then it's not adar. That's one of the roi bakar. A second one says, v'chad amar, im tur b'tzafar b'tel yamos v'tiara b'tul te'ene yad much, yishlach mashkei, deinu adar v'imlav leisein adar. And the second cattle herder said, you know, if there is snow on the mountaintops, meaning it's a cold morning, but when you get to the afternoon, you really can enjoy some shade because it's hot in the afternoon. So cold morning, warm afternoon. So basically what he's doing is describing spring. So that's adar. And if not, then it's not adar. So again, the second cattle herder is also assuming that the seasons and the Jewish months are coordinating. V'chad amar im kidim takif l'chada yehe yapach b'luech nafak l'kibolei dein adar v'im lav leisein adar. And the third one also making another general assumption that the season and the month are the same. If the winter is kind of tempered, meaning it's not as cold, and as you blow air, so you get to see a little bit of your breath, but it's not that cold, so that's adar. So on account of all this, avur rabban alai shaisa. So now, basically, what these farmers were saying was, it's not yet adar. Meaning, we don't right the seasonally weather-wise, it's not adar. These are what the cattle herders are saying. So the chachamim overheard the conversation, and the chachamim said, "Okay, oh, we have to add another month." So you see that basically the way the chachamim's manipulate and maneuver the ibryar, it comes out now that the Jewish lunar month is going to coordinate with the season. Unlike what we just saw previously, because we just saw previously that the Kohen Gadol was taking into consideration, oh no, I don't want to add a second adar because Yom Kippur is going to be really cold. Well, what do you mean? In other words, if the seasons and the Yomim Tovim coordinate with one another, like we just got done saying, why should the Kohen Gadol ever be worried about that? So the Gemara says, V'tizbar Rabbanan Aravasa Samach. The Gemara says again, let's not go crazy over here. The Chachamim were not really relying on the conversation of the cattle herders. El Rabbanan Achushbinu Samach. The Chachamim had their Chushpana, they had their accounting. Meaning, go back to the first parak of Sanhedrin, review the couple of Dapim, where the Gemara talks about the various factors involved in determining whether we're going to add another month or not. And that's it. Meaning, and yes, season is part of the calculation, but it's only part of the calculation. And the Chachamim also take those other considerations into account. And as far as that it went together with what the cattle herders were saying, that's true, but, you know, coincidence. Meaning, it's not because of the cattle herders' comments of the season that the Chachamim added or did not add another month to the year. Okay, so again, there is generally coordination between the seasons and the adding of an extra month, but it's not the only determination. And like Rav Papa said, meaning that there's going to be occasions where sometimes the seasons are and the months are not going to coordinate. Okay. Continuing in the Gemara, we are on the very bottom now of Yechezmon Beis, and we pick it up now with the Mishnah's discussion about a Kohen Gadol and Chalitza. What did the Mishnah say regarding the Kohen Gadol and Chalitza? So, as far as the Kohen Gadol himself doing Chalitza, so the Gemara says that's fine. And I'm sorry, the Mishnah told us that's fine. But in terms of him doing Yibum, so he cannot do Yibum. Okay. So let's think this through. If a Kohen Gadol is having a Yibum opportunity, so what does that mean? It means that he had a brother. The brother was married. Unfortunately, his brother died and childless. And now the widow has an opportunity. She has a Zika. She has an opportunity to do Yibum with her brother-in-law being the Kohen Gadol. Of course, the problem is that the widow's a almana. She's a widow. And that means a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry a widow. A Kohen Hedyot is allowed to marry a widow, but a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry a widow. It's an Isser Min HaTorah. So what basically we're looking at right now is a negative prohibition of a Kohen marrying an almana. Let's also compound that with another issue, and that is that the Torah says that a Kohen Gadol has a positive commandment, and that is he must marry a Basula. And his sister-in-law is not a Basula. So he is violating a negative prohibition, and he's also violating a positive obligation. In other words, he must marry a Basula. So by him marrying his brother's widow, so he'd be violating both a Lav and Aseh. And even though the mitzvah of Yibum is a mitzvah min HaTorah, but it's not going to be able to override both a Lav and Aseh. Okay, but now let's construct another scenario. Very similar, but with one small change. And that is, let's say his sister-in-law is still a basula. It sounds strange, but it's not. Meaning that what his brother did is his brother did kedushin to this woman, which means now that they're married, but it's just kedushin. In other words, the marriage was not consummated, didn't get to the second stage of marriage, and then the brother died. Is there a mitzvah of Yibum? Yep. There's a mitzvah of Yibum. So now in such a scenario, so now it's going to get a little bit trickier. Because now it's a lav, it's a negative prohibition because she's an almana, but she's a basula. So the only thing now preventing him from marrying his widow, his brother's widow, is that she's an almana. And he has a mitzvah of Yibum. And now we can use the basic rule that we learned back in the beginning of Yavamos of Ese Dochelosa say that a positive commandment is going to override the negative prohibition. And so basically now what the Gemara wants to know is would this be okay? From the Mishnah, it seems like it's not okay because the Mishnah unequivocally prohibits a Kohen Gadol from doing the mitzvah of Yibum. So the Gemara now is going to comment on all this. Kapasik Vitani, the Gemara starts off, we are three lines on from the bottom of the Amud. Kapasik Vitani lo shnamin erusin lo shnamin nesuin, it does not matter whether she was widowed from erusin or from nesuin. Now bishlamim nesuin, the Gemara is going to make the point that we already made. And that is that if she's widowed from nesuin, have the esev lo sase. The Kohen Gadol's prohibition to marry her is twofold. One, she's an almana. Two, she is not a besula. And we don't have the positive commandment of Yibum being able to override both of those. Elamin Erisin, am I? But the Gemara says, but if all she was widowed from Erisin, So then you can make a very cogent argument that he should be doing the mitzvah of Yibum. Ama yavo ase v'yitchalos ase. The positive commandment of Yibum should be overriding the lav of an almana. So the Gemara's answer is, and the Gemara in Yavamos brings the same Gemara in Yavamos, gzera b'yirishon atu b'yashniya. Tanya namehachim kid mubalu b'yirishon akanu v'asa l'kama b'yashniya. So the Gemara says like this. Very interesting answer of the Gemara. Yes, there's a mitzvah of Yibum, but you know when that mitzvah of Yibum is fulfilled through Bia Rishona, the first act of intimacy between the Yavam and the Yavama, that's the mitzvah of Yibum. What is it from that point going forward? Marriage. It's just marriage going from that point forward. So to perform the first act of Bia, which is the mitzvah of Yibum, so that would be allowed under the umbrella of Ese Dochelos Ase. The positive commandment can override the negative prohibition. But going forward, however, it's no longer the mitzvah of Yibum. It's not the formal mitzvah of Yibum. It's just marriage. And she's still an almana. Then her almana status hasn't changed. And then he'd be violating the Isser of almana. So, yeah, in theory, he could do Bia Rishona with her. But then what's going to happen after that? Obviously, what he would want to do is continue the marriage. But continuing the marriage would be an Avera. So the Chachamim said, you know what? We're just going to say no from the very beginning. And so, therefore, he won't be doing the mitzvah of Yibum from the beginning, even though you can, even though Ese Dochelo Sase, but we're the Chachamim blocked that, so you don't get to the you don't get to the near impossible situation of Biashnia. Yes. He doesn't have to continue the marriage, but I understand. But human nature is such where, in other words, okay, good. You're a halachist at heart. You just think like the halacha. But the Gemara assumes that he's going to want to continue the marriage. For the most part, it works for his brother. It might work for him as well. Okay, the mace la mace. We're continuing now. Now, the Mishnah gave a detailed description of the Kohen Gadol as it relates to funerals. Now, again, like we said back in the Mishnah, he's not going to the funeral. He's not going to the cemetery. He's a Kohen Gadol. And as such, he cannot become Tameh towards even one of the seven Krovim. With that stated, however, the Mishnah gave the Mishnah gave protocols in terms of what he should do. So in terms of following behind the funeral procession, so the Mishnah related a machlokus between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir in terms of whether or not he should follow the procession. We learned back in the Mishnah that according to Rabbi Meir, he doesn't walk immediately behind the procession, but he stays basically one alleyway behind. So the Gemara right now is just going to record a brisa that's going to share the same information. The Gemara quotes a brisa. Pretty much verbatim what we saw back in our Mishnah, and that is the idea that he's staying one alleyway behind so he doesn't come close to the body, and he does not become tummy. V'yotze et Pesach. Now, they get to the city limits, the gate of the city, and that's where he stops, meaning he doesn't go any further, and obviously the procession will continue to bury the body, and he'll then go back. Now, to which Rav Yehuda said, no. Rav Yehuda said, read the Pasuk of the Torah. The Torah says him in the Mikdash lo yetze, that he's not allowed to leave the Mikdash. And to which Rav Yehuda basically says, he doesn't follow the procession at all, not even an alley's distance behind. He does not leave the Beis HaMikdash. So that's Rav Yehuda's position in the Mishnah. And the Gemara now notes that what Rav Yehuda seems to be saying is reasonable, meaning just follow the Torah. Shapikam Rav Yehuda. So the Gemara says it's very good what Rav Yehuda said. Amlecha Rav Meir Yach LeBeis HaNaimelo. So Rav Meir says, well, you really want to take the Pasuk literally, meaning you're telling me that he can't go home? He just can't go back to his house? Min HaMikdash Lo Yetze? He's not allowed to leave the Beis HaMikdash, even to go home? Elahachi kamar, don't read the pasuk literally. But what the pasuk with the Torah means is min hamikdash lo yetze, mikdusha solo yetze. That the mikdash over here is not a geographic location. The mikdash over here means his state of kedusha became a diyslehe kera lo asa leminge. And so that means that he's just got to be careful. He's a kohen gadol. He can't become tameh. As long as you keep a safe distance between you, the kohen gadol, and the procession, the funeral procession, you're good. An alleyway's distance behind is good. And Rav Yehuda, what is Rav Yehuda going to counter to that argument? Rav Yehuda, agav marir, dilma mikre v'asiv anaga. So understand that the Kohen Gadol is very distraught. He just lost one of his seven relatives. And if you're allowing the Kohen Gadol to follow behind the procession, and even though you think it's a safe distance, but he's emotional right now. He's very distraught. And the Gemara says, and basically, it'd be very hard at that point to control himself, not to come closer to the cemetery, not to come closer to the coffin. And the Gemara says, out of his bitterness, he's going to want to come even closer. So basically, stay in the Beis HaMikdash, and that way you'll be really at a safe distance from coming into contact with Tuma. We're continuing now in the Mishnah. The Mishnah.
By Rabbi Meir, they would go up. Not Rabbi Yehuda, would say. He would go up. He would say that.
No, Yehuda usually trumped him there, right?
Yeah. The, yes. The Rambam follows like Rabbi Yehuda. That he doesn't leave the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Kishu Menachem. Okay. The Mishnah continues now, describing the extension of words of comfort from the Kohen Gadol to the mourners, or, if necessary, the other way around, from the comforters to the Kohen Gadol. Tanu Rabbanan Kishu Over B'Shura L'Nachem Asacherim. So here we're just going over protocol. What is it going to look like? Now remember, I mentioned this yesterday. I'm going to repeat this again today. And that is, there was the old minhag and the new minhag. The old minhag is that upon leaving the cemetery, so the avel himself would be stationary, and the comforters would walk past the avel. The new minhag, which we're going to be discussing later this morning in terms of why we changed, is that the comforters are stationary, they form a row, and the mourner is going to walk past the comforters, listening to the words of comfort. Okay, so here we're now describing the old minhag. And kishu over b'shura l'nachem asacherim. So now we're talking about the Kohen Gadol as being part of the line passing the avel. So here's how protocol went. Skan u'mushuch shavra b'yamino. So to his right is going to be the deputy Kohen, the skan, and also the Kohen shavar. What is that? If in the event the Kohen Gadol was temporarily removed from office, he was Tamei, he had a mom, and you needed now a replacement Kohen Gadol, a temporary substitute Kohen Gadol. So the temp is going to, as needed, serve as the Kohen Gadol. However, when the original Kohen Gadol is now in a position where he can serve the role again, so the temporary was temporary, and he's going to be removed from office. However, he still is going to have a title of Kohen Gadol. And just to differentiate, we're going to call him the Kohen Sha'avar. Okay, so he's right. He was the one who once served in the in the office of Kohen Gadol. So you're going to have now to the right of the Kohen Gadol the Skan, the deputy, and the Meshuach Shavar. And then Verosh Beis Av Avilam V'Chol Ha'am Mismalo. And you're going to have now on his left the head of the Beis Din and the other people who are extending comfort. And of course the Avil himself are going to be to his left. And now they'll be walking past now in this protocol, in this procession. And now the Avel is going to be towards his left, and as he's walking by, he's going to be extending words of comfort. Now, Kishu'omi B'Shura, now, let's go where now the Kohen Gadol is the one receiving the words of comfort. Now, this is not going to be at the cemetery, because he's a Kohen Gadol, but still, you're still going to have this procession of people walking past him to extend words of comfort to the Kohen Gadol. So, again, now, we're just looking here at protocol. Kishu'omi B'Shura, Meznachem E'acherim, and he's receiving Nechama from others, Skan Miyamino. So you have the deputy to his right, Verosh Beis Av, V'Chol Ha'am Mismalo, and the people are going to be towards his left. I'm sorry, the Av Beis Din and the people are going to be towards his left. Ava Meshuch Sha'avar Lo Asigabe. The Meshuch Sha'avar, the temporary Kohen Gadol is not going to be there when the Kohen Gadol is receiving words of comfort. Why not? The Gemara goes on to explain. My Tamach Chal Shadai Tesavar Ki Chadi Bi. And the reason why it's explained to Gemara is because he has a somewhat of a contentious relationship with the Meshuach Sha'avar. Consider that at one point in time, in other words, he currently is a Kohen Gadol, he was the Kohen Gadol, but there was a temporary period of time where this guy served his office. And so, okay, the relationship is a little bit tense. It's human nature. I'd like to think that we're all above it, but, you know, we're all humans. So the relationship is a little bit contentious. Now, on the situation where the Kohen Gadol is now in mourning. He's an avel. So for the Meshuch Sha'avar to be there at that point in time would be a little bit contentious. And the Gemara makes exactly that comment. Chal Shadaita Savaki Chadibi. When he sees the Meshuch Sha'avar at this very emotional time, he's thinking, oh, you know what? Never liked me to begin with. And he's probably happy at this point in time. So, which parenthetically leads to a very, very interesting and important halachic discussion in terms of if, let's say, you have a relationship with somebody that's not good. I mean, Rahman al-Islam. But if you, let's say, you have a relationship with somebody that's not on the good side, but, in other words, you have a contentious relationship with him, and he's an avel, should you be Menachem Avel? Should you go visit him? It sounds like from our Gemara, the answer is no. That if you know that he's not going to be happy to see you, so don't go visit when he's in Avel. Now this is I'm really truncating the entire discussion. It's a lengthy discussion in terms of whether you should or you shouldn't. But our Gemara is a source of this very question of whether or not you should be visiting somebody in Avelus if you know that he does not like you. Not clear. And it's not totally clear. In other words, I understand. In other words, but he's not allowed to go out for the funeral. But after the funeral, like, you know, he could leave the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Amar Papa Shmamina Mehama Sisatlat. Three things that we learn from this Brisa, says Rav Papa. Number one, Shmamina, Hainu Skan, Hainu Mamuna. So, first of all, the Mishnah used the word Mamuna, the Brisa used the word Skan, it's the same. They're synonymous. Deputy Kohen. And Ushmamina Avila Mamdim Vikalam over him. And also, the Avel is stationary. And the people who are providing the comfort, they're going to be walking by, like we described. Ushmamina avelim the small menachmim hein omdim. And in terms of the correct procedure, so the avel should be to the left of the one giving the comfort. So in other words, as the one who's giving the comfort is walking by, the avel should be to his left. Okay. Tana Rabbana. Gemara quotes a brisa. Rishon ha'yu avelim omdim v'chol ha'am ovrim. So the brisa over here gives us the old minhag, which we've gone over now a couple of times, and that is it used to be the avel was stationary, and the menachmim, the one who were giving the comfort, are walking by. However, ayu beis mishpachos b'yushalayim mitgarit zu bazu. Zos emeres ani over eschila, zos emeres ani over eschila. Two families in Yerushalayim fought to be who should be first in line, each one feeling that their pedigree was greater, and therefore they should be more, they should be in the front of the line. And the two families were fighting as they were performing the mitzvah of Nicham Avelim. Again, another reflection on the human condition. That's, unfortunately, you know, that's who we are sometimes. So, but it's terrible, meaning now is not the time to be fighting. Now should be the time where we're focusing on the Avel. So, Hitkinish Yuam Omdim Avelim Ovrim. So the Chachamim felt that to alleviate the situation, to ameliorate, so what we're going to do is now we're going to change the protocol, where we're going to have the Avel walking, and we're going to have the ones who are extending the comfort, they're going to be stationary. There's no first in line, there's no beginning of the line. You know, I guess you can even argue that point, but it does improve the situation, and the Gemara says, and for that reason, the minhag changed. Continuing in the Gemara, Chazar Halach Sipur Siman, the Gemara gives us a mnemonic, and now the Gemara is going to quote three halachas which were instituted by Rabbi Yossi and Sipori. Amar Rami Bar Abba, Hichzir Rabbi Yossi, Esadar V'Liyoshna B'Tzipori, Shiu Avelim Omnim V'Cholam Ovrim. One institution that Rabbi Yossi did in Sipori is that he took the minhag and he reverted back to the old minhag. Two. Amar Rami Abba Ahitkin Rabbi Yosef Bitzipori Shalote Isha Malachas Beshukov Na Achareha Mishamaisa Shahaya. When a woman's walking in the marketplace with her child should be walking in front of her, not behind her. It used to be the practice was the child walked behind the mother. But because of an incident, which the Gemara here does not elaborate upon, but because of an incident, so therefore Rabbi Yosef instituted that when a mother's walking with a child, the child should be walking in front of the mother, not behind the mother. What's the incident? So, as generally, when you see a Gemara like this, so you just turn to Rashi, and Rashi usually discloses what the incident was. That's, in fact, the case over here. I read the Rashi inside. Mishim Maisa Shaya, Shenigbu Pritzim Me'acharev V'nasnu Bebayis. Okay, so it's a real tragedy. So what happened was is that the child was walking behind the mother, and the child was abducted, and the mother didn't immediately notice because the child was walking behind. She turns around a little bit later, she sees her child is not there, and she starts screaming and crying. So one of the abductors says to the mother, I know where the child is, come with me and I'll show you. And then they took her into the house and they violated her. So obviously terrible tragedy. And the Gemara says, so what Rabbi Yossi instituted is now that the child is going to be walking in front of the mother, not behind the mother. Now I'm thinking, meaning what was the basis of the quote unquote old minug? So I'm thinking it has to do with the fact that it's not bechavod, it's not honor to have the child walking in front of a parent.
Yosef did with Rachel also in front
of Right, right. So it's not covered. So therefore, the old minhag was, in other words, and I'm guessing, but I'm just guessing though. I don't know if what I'm saying is correct, but I'm guessing that has to do with kibbutz avim, that the child should be walking, should be tailing the parent, not walking in front of the parent. But as it now serves as a potential threat to both child and to mother, so therefore they put the child in front. Another institution, Rabbi Yossi. A third one, Va'amarami Barama Itkim Rabbi Yossi Pitsiparshi Unashim Bisapros Bebesakise. Although it is improper and inappropriate to speak in a bathroom, but if two women are in the bathroom, they should be speaking to one another. He encourages the women to speak to one another. Mishum Yichud, and the Gemara immediately explains it has to do with Yichud. Rashi says, let's consider. Back in the good old days, so they didn't have indoor plumbing. Okay, which question? Then you can question whether or not they really were good old days. And so you had to go out to the outhouse in order to go to the bathroom. Now there wasn't a man in a woman's latrine. It was all the same. And so it could be now that if you have women going to the bathroom, so it could be that a man, not because he's a bad person, just simply because he didn't know, is going to go into the bathroom when there are two women there. A man and two women is still a violation of Yichud. So in order to avoid the situation, so what Rav Yossi told the women when they go to the bathroom is make sure to talk so that people know that you're there. So if a man hears your voice, so the man's not going to go in. Amar Rav Menashe bar Ava Shilta Rav Yossi Rabba Bebeis Ilmin de Hutzal. We asked Rabbi Yoshia, the great Rabbi Yoshia, in the cemetery of Hutzal, the Amrli, and Shur Pchusa Measar B'nei Adam. When making this line in order to provide comfort for the mourner, so the line should be made up of 10. Ve'ein Avela min a minyan. And an Avel is not part of the minyan. Now, this is not a function of Kaddish, meaning I know we are so hardwired to think about cemetery, Kaddish, but this is not Kaddish. This has to do with Nicham Avelim. This has to do with the mitzvah of comforting the mourner. Now, I know it's not about Kaddish because when it comes to Kaddish, obviously you count the Avel as part of the minyan for Kaddish. But in other words, this has to do with Nicham. In other words, and to provide the requisite necessary Nechama, the proper comfort, so there should be a quorum of people there. So there should be a minyan. And in addition to the Avel himself. And it doesn't matter which minhag you follow. You follow the old minhag, you follow the new minhag, in terms of who's stationary, who's moving, but still there should be a minion there at the funeral. It's a fair question. It doesn't say, if I'm right, that this is not a function of Kaddish, this is just a function of Nechama, so then you could make the argument that it shouldn't matter whether it's men or women. Okay, no, but I'm right now, all I'm doing is thinking out loud. I don't have a source to what I'm saying, but okay, it seems reasonable. Okay, kishuhu mitnachim v'chule ibaylu kimnachim hu achrini hechi amr lehu. Okay, notably absent from the Mishnah is we know if he's an avah what the people are saying to him. And if you remember, the Mishnah told us in yesterday's daf, right? Anu kaparascha. We're like, we should be an atonement to you. So that's what the comforts would say if the Kohen Gadol was a mourner. But what the Mishnah didn't tell us yesterday was, what if the Kohen Gadol is there and he's extending words of comfort to the Avel? What does he say to them? The Mishnah didn't tell us. So the Gemara would like to fill in that blank. So Hechi Amar Lehu Tashma Vehu Amar Tisnachamu. So the Gemara quotes a Braisa, and the Braisa has a one word statement by the Kohen Gadol, you should be comforted. Now, Hechi Dami, the Gemara says, now, what was that? Meaning, the Braisa didn't give us the context. Was that his response to being comforted? Or was that his statement of comfort? Now, Elam, Kemenachem, Achrin, Lididei, Amalu, Iyu, Tesnachamu. So the Gemara says, now, if you understand this to be a response to being comforted, so the Gemara says, can't be. That doesn't make any sense. Nachsha Karamilahu, consider. They're saying to him, Kohen Gadol, you're in Avelis right now, we're comforting you, and his response to them is, you too should be comforted. Which almost sounds like, well, you know, when you get to this condition of being an Avel yourself, so you should be comforted. That's not appropriate. So the Gemara says, Elokim, Menachem, Lachrin, Amalut, Tesnachamu. So clearly what the Braisa is describing is, the statement he's making as a comforter to an avil, where if he's there and the avil's there and he's providing words of comfort, so what he says is that you should be comforted, tisnachamu. Okay, that ends the discussion on the Gemara of the Kohen Gadol. So we talk now about the Kohen Gadol. Quick summary, Kohen Gadol can be part of the whole judicial process. He can serve as a judge. He could serve as a witness. His only limitation is that he can't be part of the Ibur Shana process. But for all intents and purposes, he could be part of the judicial process. And then as long as the Mishnah went on to detail some of the halachas as of the Kohen Gadol, either during mourning or being a comforter to a mourner. So the Gemara now filled in a lot of the blanks of the Mishnah and just made a number of observations regarding the Kohen Gadol and Avelus. We're now moving to the second half of the Mishnah. Now we're talking about a king. And for the rest of today's daf, tomorrow's daf, we're going to be talking now about a king. The first comment we made in the Mishnah regarding a king is that Melech lo dan, he cannot serve as a judge, nor can he be tried himself. As I mentioned in the beginning of today's shiur, the simplest reading of the Mishnah would indicate that, as it relates to the king, so he is to be taken literally, he's above the law. Now, I don't mean by that. In other words, I say above the law, meaning he is not part of the legal system. Okay. Now, what if he does something wrong? What are you going to do with such a king? Okay, I understand the question is very strong. But just a simple reading of the Mishnah would seem to indicate that he cannot serve in the judge, he cannot be tried. That's a simple reading of the Mishnah. Amar Rav Yosef lo shanu ala macha yisrael. So what Rav Yosef now does is he puts a serious limitation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was only describing macha yisrael. You're a king, but you're not from Davidic dynasty. Now that's kind of paradoxical, because we know that we're instructed that every king of the Jewish people should be from Davidic dynasty. He should come from Beis David, and he really should be coming from Shevet Yehuda. Yaakov tells Yehuda, Lo Sasser Shevet, that the throne should not go away from Yehuda. But we also know that historically, although that's the best case scenario, historically many kings of the Jewish people were not from Beis David. In fact, towards the beginning of Bais Rishon, a split occurred in the Jewish people, and basically there was an entire kingdom set up in the north, run by non-Davidic kings for centuries. And even during the second Beis HaMikdash, we know that the Hashmonaim took over and asserted themselves as kings for a number of generations. So even though, of course, the best case scenario is to have a melech from Beis David, but we had many scenarios where they were not. So when our Mishnah told us that a king cannot judge and be judged, says Rav Yosef, that's only for Malchus Yisrael, that's only if you're not Davidic. But if you're from Davidic dynasty, so then you can be a judge and you can be tried. And it's a pasuk in Navi. The pasuk says, Beis David, ko amar Hashem dino lavoker mishpat. We know that the Pasuk Yirmiyahu says that the Beis David could serve as a judge. And once you know that you could serve as a judge, so then the inflection, of course, is true. V'ilo denin le, ino hechi daini. Well, if you can't be tried, then you can't serve as a judge. Because the Pasuk, which we quoted yesterday from Tzfanya, recording again today, v'aksiv, it's kosher shuv'koshuv, amrish lakish, kishot atzmechavacha kach kishot acherim. You correct yourself first, and then you correct others. So in order to be a judge, you have to be in a situation where you yourself can be judged. So for Malchus Beis David, the Pasuk Yirmiyahu tells us very straightforward that you could serve as a judge, and if you could serve as a judge, that means that you could be tried as well. So, Ela Machi Yisrael, my time alone. So it begs, of course, the question, which is, so if you're Machi Yisrael, why is it that you're now going to be divorced from the judicial process? Why can you not be a judge? Why can't you be judged if you're from Machi Yisrael? So the Gemara says, Mishum Maisa Shahaya. So the Gemara says it's based on an episode. Now here the Gemara goes through great detail in terms of outlining what the episode was. A quick word of introduction. During Bais Sheni, so there was, the Greeks took over early in Bais Sheni. Very early on in Bais Sheni, we know that Shimon HaTzadik was Shayari Knesset HaGedola. He was from the Anshe Knesset HaGedola, which started by Sheni, and Shimon HaTzadik was the remnant of the Shayera Knesset Gedola, and already in his lifetime, so Alexander took over. Alexander conquered the world. And the Gemara in Yuma goes through details, right? There's a famous Gemara over there that outlined the confrontation between Shimon HaTzadik and Alexander the Great. Okay, so in other words, so basically the Greek Empire took over. Now, we also know that with the Greek Empire, so we have basically the incident of Hanukkah. So about halfway through Bayis Sheni. And after the Hashmonaim defeated the Greeks and rededicated the Beis HaMikdash, so then the Hashmonaim also usurped the throne as well, and they took over the monarchy. Now the Hashmonaim were Kohanim, which means that they were from Sheva Levi, and I'm not saying this, the Ramban is saying this, I'm just repeating the Ramban, and they should not have taken over the throne, and they should not have assumed the monarchy of the Jewish people, but they did. And so, of that dynasty of the Hashmonaim, so one of the kings that came out was Yanai. We know about Yanai HaMelech based on our Gemara here, Sanhedrin Yates. The Gemara, the end of the seventh parak of Brachos, and the Gemara in Kiddushin. And exactly who his identity was, so the Amoraim actually debate that very issue in terms of who his identity was. Meaning, but for our purposes right now, we could say very simply that he was from Beis Hashmonai. Okay, that's the easiest way to say it. And we also know that he was not good. He had a terrible hatred for the Chachamim. In fact, tragically, he killed Chachamim. He killed Chachmei Yisrael. He was a Sone Chachamim. And then, oddly enough, one other piece of background information that we need to know is that he was married to the sister of Shimon Meshetach. Shimon Meshetach, who's one of the Zugos, meaning go through Pirkei Avos, you're going to find, after Shimon HaTzadik, I know I just quoted Shimon HaTzadik, you're going to find five Zugos, and of the five Zugos, of the five pairs that spiritually led the Jewish people, so one of them was Shimon Meshetach. I think he's the third pair. You can fact check me on that. But I'm going off the top of my head. So I think he's of the third pair. Anyway, so Yana HaMelech now is married to Shimon Meshetach's sister. So as much as he hated the Chachamim, but Shimon Meshetach operated with a certain amount of immunity in that Yana didn't want to, you know, I'm sure he would have loved to have killed his brother-in-law, but it's his brother-in-law, so, you know, he was under some sort of protection. With all that stated, let's now go into the Gemara. We're now going to be learning together the incident that really prompted the Mishnah to flatly say that no longer are we going to have a king as part of the judicial system, the judicial process. And again, we're saying now it's only limited to Machi Yisrael. And Yanai, of course, is Machi Yisrael. He's not from Davidic dynasty. Gemara starts off the story as follows. Avda Diana Malka Katal Nafsha. So the slave of Yanai HaMelech killed somebody. And so now the slave of Yanai Melch is being tried for murder. Amru Shimon Meshetach L'Chachamim, Tenu Einechem Bo Unidu Nenu. So Shimon Meshetach says, okay, we gotta take the man to trial. So, and Shalchu Le'Avdecha Katal Nafsha. So now a summons was sent to Yanai HaMelech and said that your slave killed somebody. So Shadruhu Lehu. So Yanai Melch says, fine, so I'll send my slave into court. And Yanai Melch sends the slave to court. Shalchu Le, a second summons now was sent to Yanai Melch. Ta'ant Nami Lahacha. You got to come as well. It is your slave. So although he's being tried, but you got to come as well. Why? Because we know who had Bevalav. Amar Torah. Because we know that when a person's animal is being tried for killing, meaning we're describing over here about a shor and his skull. So we also know that the owner of the animal has to come to court as well. If the owner of the animal, of course, is not being killed, but nevertheless, he's got to come to court. Yanai HaMelech, he's your eved, he's your property, so you also need to come to court as well. Yavo Baal HaShor V'yamod Al Shoro. So the owner of the shor has to come. You, Yanai HaMelech, are the Baal HaShor. I understand we're not talking about an animal over here, we're talking about an eved, but just legally speaking, it is the property of the king, and therefore you need to come as well. Asav Yasif. So now Yanai HaMelech has the displeasure of having to sit in court and watch his slave now stand trial. So Amar Shimon Meshetach Yanai HaMelech Amar Avaglecha V'yayidu Becha. So now Shimon Meshetach turns to his brother-in-law and says, okay, you have to stand now because we're about to testify against you. And don't think that you're just standing in front of us, you're standing in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Meaning, we're not asking you to stand because of us, meaning you're the king. So obviously that would be disrespectful for us to demand that you stand in front of us. But remember now, as a Sanhedrin, Hashem is here as well. The Pasuk says, Shenemar, Vamdu Shenashem Asher Lehem Ariv. And the Pasuk goes on to conclude, the Gemara doesn't quote it, using the words, Lifnei Hashem. So when you're standing in front of a court, you are standing Lifnei Hashem, so you have to stand. So Shema Meshechka says, Yana Hamelch, you need to stand. So Amar Lo, Lo, Kishetomer Ata, Elekamashi Omer Chavarecha. So Yana Melch says to his brother-in-law Shema Meshetach, I am tired of hearing from you. I do not want to hear. These instructions from you don't mean anything to me. Let me hear from some of your colleagues. If your colleagues are ready to talk to me in the same manner that you're talking to me, okay. But I'd like to hear it from them. So now Shema Meshetach hopes and prays that he's now going to get support from his colleagues. But if I could, we just defend them for just a moment. I know what the reaction is going to be. I looked ahead. So if we could just defend them for a moment, this is Yana Yamelch who kills Talmid Chachamim. So for them to voice an opinion right now is basically a death sentence. Now, in other words, I understand you need to be courageous. You should be courageous, but it's a lot easier said than done. Okay, but. Nifna liyamino kafshu panem bakarka. Nifna l'smalo kafshu panem bakarka. So Shimon Meshetach turns to his right, to the members of the Sanhedrin to his right, and they put their head right down. And then he turns to the left, and they too, those members of the Sanhedrin, put their head right down. And Amar lam Shimon Meshetach. So Shimon Meshetach now is furious over the fact that he thought that he was going to get support from the Sanhedrin, and he did not. And they were too scared to say anything. So Balei Machshav Asata Atem. And he describes them as Balei Machshava. You guys are deep in thought. In other words, and we'll put air quotes on that. Mm-hmm. Right? You guys are so deep in thought. Yavo Balei Machshava v'yipar mechem. And so the Balei Machshava, meaning the one who's really deep in thought, meaning a Kadosh Baruch Hu, so he should extract retribution from you. Meaning, basically, he gave the strongest reprimand. I am so disappointed with everybody here not standing up and saying anything to Yanai Melech. Miad ba Gavriel v'chavta mekarko umesu umesu. And along comes Gavriel and takes the faces of the Sanhedrin and plants them into the ground, and they all died. And obviously, this event was obviously a terrible tragedy. But oso shah amru melech lo dan v'lo dan oso lo mei v'lo mei dan oso. And this incident is the genesis of our Mishnah, and this is where the Mishnah gets its line from, that a king cannot serve as a judge nor be tried, cannot testify nor can be testified against. It's because of this episode. But this episode was specifically with Yanai HaMelech, and therefore the ruling of the Mishnah is only limited to Machay Yisrael, not to Machay Beis David. Continuing in the Gemara, lochols v'locholtsin. Okay, we're describing now a king as it relates to chalitza. Okay, let's think about what's happening. You have a king's brother who died and left his widow a childless. I mean, of course. Under such a situation, now the king has a mitzvah of yibum opportunity, and if he doesn't want to do yibum, he does chalitza. And the Mishnah says the king should be doing neither. Neither should the king be doing yibum, or should the king do chalitza. It of course begs the question: why not? What's the problem? We're talking about a mitzvah over here. What's the problem? So let's take this step by step. Let's start off with chalitza. I know I'm working backwards, but let's start with chalitza. So what I'm saying right now is Rashi. I'm not saying anything original. So so with chalitza, it's totally disrespectful to the king, because part of the chalitza process is that she's going to be spinning in his direction. Okay, misconception, by the way. She spits in the shoe. That's not the case. She spits in his direction. He's a king. Meaning, and that'd be totally disrespectful, and there has to be emes hamelech. There has to be fear and awe of the king. So the idea that she's going to spin the king, and yes, she's doing so in the process of a mitzvah, but still. It's totally disrespectful. It's a lack of cover for the king. So chalitza is going to be a breach of cover, and therefore no chalitza. What about yibum? So here, this is really interesting. So Rashi says that Yibam is also disrespectful for the king. In what way is Yibam disrespectful? Because the child that they have is not really going to be the king's child. Remember, Yibam is basically, it's surrogacy. I know it's a lot to think about over here, but I'll say it really simply and really quickly. In other words, when you are doing the mitzvah of Yibam and you're fathering the child, so biologically the child is yours, but meta, And every other way, the child really is your brother's child. And what you're basically doing is that you are producing a child that is not yours. Biologically, yes, yours. Genetically, yes, yours. But it's not yours. It's your brother's child. La hakim shem. So for a king to father such a child is also going to be a breach of kavod. That's how Rashi describes why the king should not be doing the mitzvah of yibum. Okay, so in the Mishnah, if you remember, that was the position of the Tanakhama. And Rav Yehuda said in the Mishnah, well, if the king wants to, then he has the option. The Gemara now picks up on this point. The Ini, the Gemara is bothered. The Gemara over here is bothered by Rav Yehuda's position, which is the king has the option in doing the mitzvah of Yibum or Chalitza. The Gemara says, I don't understand. We saw this back in the Gemara in Kiddushin. If a leader, meaning a Nasi, not a formal king, but like, you know, like Rabbi Gamliel or, you know, a leader of the Jewish people. So if he wants to forego his kavod, and if he wants to waive it, okay. Not recommended, but he can. A king does not have the right to waive his kavod. The Pasuk says, so basically what the Gemara is asking is, within the opinion of Rabbi Huda, where the king has an option of either doing the mitzvah of Yimur or Chalitza, the Gemara says, what do you mean? You're a king. You can't just simply say, oh, it's okay, it's fine. I know it's my honor, but you know what? I'll waive my honor. As a king, you're not allowed to waive your honor. So by what right then can the king be involved in either the mitzvah of Yibum or Chalitza if it's going to be disrespectful and if it's going to be a pchas kavod, a diminishment of his honor, he shouldn't do it. So the Gemara gives two word answer, mitzvah shani. So the Gemara says, yeah, but this is a mitzvah. And because this is a mitzvah, it's not dishonor to the king to be involved in these acts of either Yibum or Chalitza. And so says Rabbi Yehuda that his position is that in the context of a mitzvah, it's not a lack of kavod. And I guess, I mean, there's obviously much more to analyze over here. And the Chachamim disagree on what point. That a mitzvah is different, or maybe that this mitzvah is different. Meaning, obviously, you have to fill in a lot of the blanks over here. What then is the machlokus between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda? Okay, but we're going to go on. Einosim v'chulei. Tanya, Amalola Rabbi Yehuda. We're now talking about the widows of the king. You remember the Mishnah told us that according to the Tanakhama, once you're married to the king, that's it. In other words, that's your marriage. In the event that the king dies and you're now the widow, so the Tanakhama says that nobody can marry you. Okay, it's I understand it's an uncomfortable situation to be in life, but that's the sheet of the Tanakhama. And Rabbi Yehuda says no, there is an option for her to get married again, and that is to the next king. And not necessarily the very next king, but in other words, another king can pick her up. Now, and Rabbi Yehuda seemingly in the Mishnah had a really good proof, and that was David HaMelech. Because David HaMelech seemingly married the widows of Shaul HaMelech. Okay, so where do we go from here? That's as far as the Mishnah took us. So now the Gemara is going to go a little bit further. Amar lo Rabbi Yehuda, Nashim Ha'ru'yus lo mi'beis HaMelech. So the Chachamim say to Rabbi Yehuda, you did not understand the pasuk in Shmuel correctly. It did not mean that David married the widows of Shaul. He married the daughters of Shaul. U'mayniu Merav u'Michal. And who he married was Merav u'Michal. Now this obviously leads to the next question, which is a really straightforward question. Wait a second. Merav u'Michal, they're sisters. How can David and Melech marry sisters? Follow-up question. Well, how could that be? How can he marry two sisters? So answer number one is that he married Michal after Meirav died. Now, remember, we said this back in Yevamos, keep this rule or by you. Once an erva, always an erva. That if a woman is an erva to you, so even if her cause for erva is no longer there, she's still going to be an erva. Which means that, for example, let's say she was your aunt, and let's say your uncle died, she's still your aunt. Meaning, as far as Arias is concerned, she's still your aunt, and it would be an instrument of Torah to marry her. There is one notable exception. I guess you could say two, a married woman, but there's one notable exception, that's sisters. Sisters, the Torah says, is only an erva, only when only when the sister's alive. But once the sister's dead, then you're allowed to marry her sister, even though she once was an heir to you, but upon the death of her sister, meaning your wife, so you're allowed to marry the sister. A notable exception to the rule. So, the Gemara says that first Avraham HaMelech married Merav, Merav dies, then he marries Michal. That's answer number one. Answer number two, a much more complicated answer. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karchamer, Kiddushi Taos Avalei ben Merav. That when David HaMelech married Merav, he did so under false pretenses, which we're going to explain what that is in just a moment. And therefore, the marriage was never a marriage. He was never married to Merav. And therefore, he married Michal because he was never married to Merav. Shenemar Tanai, Sishias Michal Asher, Arasti Li Bemer Arelos Plishtim. The pasuk when describing David HaMelech demanding Michal back, so he says, "I married her, and the kesef kedushin. I know it's a bit of an oddity, but the kesef kedushin was the 100 foreskins that he when he defeated the plishtim." So my Talmud, and then the Gemara says, "Now how does that tell us anything about his marriage with Merav?" So the Gemara says, "Amar Papa Michal Ishti v'lo Merav Ishti." In other words, because when he says Michal Ishti, my wife, that meant to the exclusion of Merav, meaning that he was never married to Merav, even though it looked like he was married to Merav, but he was never married to Merav. My kedusha taus dichsiv. The Gemara goes on to explain what happened. So now we're going back to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, where when confronted with Galias, so Shaul said, "Whoever defeats him, so I'm going to make him wealthy, and I'm going to give him my daughter." Okay, so Azakatle. So to make a long story short, says the Gemara, David kills Galias. So Amrlo Milva Islech Gabai. So now David says, "Look, I'll marry your daughter, and as far as what the Kesef Kedushin is, well, you owe me anyway, so let's forgive the obligation, and I'll marry your daughter based on the forgiveness of the obligation." And this is what is called being Mekadosh B'Milva. The Gemara in the beginning of Masechta Kedushin says that HaMekadosh B'Milva Eina Mekadeshes. If I marry a woman, and the Kesef Kedushin is not that I hand her money, but I forgive a loan, the Kedushin is not a good Kedushin. Rashi over there in the Gemara Kedushin goes on to explain the reason why, is because when you lend money, so Milva Lo Hotsa Nitna, meaning the expectation is that the money is spent, and what they're going to have to pay you with is new money, so when you forgive the loan, they don't have the money. So therefore, you're not being Mekadosh with any actual money. Anyway, so this is, the Gemara says, this is how David was being Mekadosh Merav through the forgiveness of a loan. And the Gemara here just spells out what we already just said. HaMekadosh B'Milva Eina Mekadeshes. Okay. So Azal Yahaveh LaAdriel. So then what Shaul did is he then took Merav and handed Merav over to Adriel, to marry Adriel. Dichsiv Ayibayis Tesis Merav Basho LaDavid V'chulei. Okay. So Amrlei Ibayis Te'etain Lecha Michal, Zil Aisili, Mea Arelos Plishtim. So now, moving along now in David's storyline with the next order of Shaul. So Shaul says to David, "Look, if you kill 100 plishtim and give me the foreskins of the 100 plishtim, so based on that, so then you can marry my next order, Michal." Azal Isa lay, and again, to make a really long story short, that's exactly what he did. Killed the plishtim, handed over the foreskins to his father-in-law. So now, what we have over here is David is marrying Michal based on really two things. One, still Shaul has a debt to pay. In other words, he owes David money for killing Galias. And two, he's actually handing over something of value. So now this is halachically what is called as a milva and a pruta. And so now, Amalei Milva Pruta Islech Gabai. So he's being Mekadesh with two things. One which works, which is the Pruta, and one which does not work, which is the cancellation of the Milva. So, Shaul Savar, and so then the Gemara now boils this down to what each of the participants are thinking. Shaul's of the opinion Milva Pruta Daite Amilva, that when a person marries a woman with a Milva and a Pruta, he is primarily thinking about the milva, and therefore the kedushin does not work. And David says, "Milva pruta daita pruta." And David says, "No. That when a man is being mekadesh a woman using a milva and a pruta, so primarily the person thinking about the pruta, not the milva." So that is now the Gemara's description of why David's marriage to Merav did not work because it was strictly a milva, and Hamakash b'milva in the Mekadeshes. Masha'en came when David married Michal, so he married Michal with the cancellation of a loan and the handing over of something of value. And that's why David was of the impression that this marriage was a good marriage. Just give me 1 second, I'm sorry. The Gemara says like this. No, everyone really is of the opinion that if you're marrying a woman using both a milva and a pruta, primarily your mind is on the pruta, which means that it should work. Now, as far as what did Shaul receive for Michal's marriage, for the marriage of Michal? So he received foreskin. So as far as Shaul was concerned, look, I know that's what I demanded, but it doesn't have value. And V'David Saver Chazu L'Kavei V'Shinrei. And David says, "What do you mean it doesn't have value? Of course it has value. Meaning that you're right. All this is really, really distasteful. But you can take the foreskins and you can feed it to your animals. It has a value. And so the Gemara says that's another way to describe the machlokas. Let me just plow ahead a little bit more. Let me just get to the two dots, and then I'll pause. I'll breathe. I'll take questions. Rav Yossi, hi Tanas Ishi es Michal my Darish Bey. Now, Rav Yossi, by the way, who disagreed, meaning Rav Yossi was of the opinion that he did in fact marry both women. So what he's going to do about the pasuk that we described earlier, where we darshan that only Michal was his wife, but not Merav. What is Rav Yossi going to darshan with that pasuk? So the Gemara says, Rav Yossi the Tami, the Tanya, Rav Yossi I darsh mikros muravim. So the Gemara says, as far as Rav Yossi was concerned, it didn't bother him. Why? Because, for example, Ksiva yikach hamelch eshnei bnei ritzba bas ayasha yalda l'shaul es armanivas mipiboshes ves chameshes bnei Michal, the five children of Michal, Asher Yadal, Le Edriel, Amichulasi. And this pasuk sounds like Michal was married to who? To Edriel. The Gemara says, what? In other words, you don't have to know a lot of Nach. In fact, all you had to do was just pay attention to today's daf, which is also not a small thing. But in other words, but we know Edriel married Merav, not Michal. And the Gemara is bothered by that very simple question. And not only that, but she also was married to, and Michal was married to Palti ben Laish. Eshes David Palti ben Laish. And Michal went to Palti ben Laish, not to Edriel. So the Psukim and the Navi are confusing us. Ela Mekish Kedushi Merav La Edriel, the Kedushi Michal La Palti. So Rav Yossi will tell us that basically what the Psukim and the Navi are doing is not recording who married who, but basically what's the status of the marriage. Just like Merav's marriage was to Adriel, so too was Michal's marriage to Palti. Ma kedushin Michal lePalti ba'avera. Now, was Michal married to Palti sanctioned? No, of course it wasn't sanctioned, because Michal was the wife of David HaMelech. So the marriage between Michal and Palti is not a sanctioned marriage. So Av Kedushin Merav LeAdriel BeAvera. So too is the marriage between Merav and Adriel. It's a non-sanctioned marriage. And why is it a non-sanctioned marriage? Because Merav was actually married to David. And so therefore, for Merav to marry somebody else would be not sanctioned. Rav Yeshua Menkarcha, Nami Aksiv, it's Chamesha B'nei Michal, Ba Shaul. So now, what is Rav Yeshua Menkarcha going to do with that pasuk that we just quoted? Amlecha Rav Yeshua, V'chi Michal Yalada, V'lo Merav Yalada. The Gemara says, well, Michal didn't father, sorry. Michal didn't mother the children, Merav mothered the children. But Merav Yalada, Michal Gidla. But Merav was the mother of the children, but Michal raised the children. Lefichach nikra shma. And what the pasuk is teaching us is that when you raise a child, it's like your child. Lamdecha shekol amigado yasam b'tzoch beiso, mala alav akasav kilo yalado. That if you raise a child in your house, it says if you gave birth to that child, and that's what the pasuk and the Navi is trying to communicate to us. Again, let's just recap the second half of today's daf. The discussion of a king being involved in chalitz and yibum. The Mishnah says no. Rabbi Yehuda says optional. The Gemara went on to explain that machlokas. And then we talked about the widow of a king. If a woman's married to a king, the king dies. So who can she marry? So the Tanakhama says nobody. And Rav Yehuda says that another king may marry her. And then this prompted a lengthy discussion and debate in the Gemara regarding David HaMelech and his marriage to the two daughters of Shaul. So, and we have a number of opinions in the Gemara. In terms of of those daughters, which ones did David actually marry? So one opinion is that he married both, but they're sisters, so it must be that he married Michal only after the death of Merav. Another opinion is that he only was married to Michal, he was never married to Merav, and it had to do with a failure of the Kedushin, and the Gemara explored the details of that failure.